You are
Thank you, Dick, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Tom Phillips, and I'm the convener for today's service. Now, many of you will know that UUs have no required creed. We believe in the liberal idea that each person has a path, whether it is working towards inner peace, for particular social justice goals, or toward other religious destinations. Wherever you've come, whoever you are, whoever you love, whatever your journey has been, it has led you here, and we're glad to have you. Okay, please draw your attention to the announcements in the order of worship for today. And I have one announcement that just came through, and it's very relevant to the narthex at the back. The Aesthetics Committee invites you to enjoy the new art exhibit in the narthex. That's just out the back door here in that area, like a lobby, I guess. And Dick was the one. Are you the chair of the committee, Dick?
No.
Oh. Okay. But you see, they're loosely governed, and that's good. It's quite artistic. Okay. Okay, announcements. I extend a warm welcome to any visitors and guests today. And if you are a visitor or guest, please sign the guest book in the welcome table, also in the narthex. And after the service, we hope that all can gather for coffee and conversation in the Alsop room, which is down the hall on the left. Okay. And Clara, actually, could you help with lighting the chalice? I did a quick survey, and she said yes to both of my questions after I... Okay. And please hear this reading about chalice lighting from Christine Robinson. We gather this hour as a people of faith with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together. Okay. Please stand as you're able and join in singing our opening hymn, number 297. 297 in the dark-colored hymnal, hardback, Star of Truth. And we even have more music. So today, please enjoy the music offered by Jim Chanteau, one of our long-distance members, on the alto sax with a medley of tunes from the musical play West Side Story, accompanied by Renee.
A quick word before I start. Many of you may know that this is the 100th anniversary of Leonard Bernstein's birthday. He was born August 25th, 1918, so almost exactly a month ago. And musical groups all around the country agreed that this year everybody would play something by Bernstein. So that's why you maybe hear him go to concerts or shows, whatever. So this is my contribution to the year of Bernstein.
Thank you.
Wow. Who recognized at least half those songs? Okay, good. Who knew who did the very first piece that was on the tape before we came in? No, don't worry about that. All right, well, at this time, we ask that I invite any children, teens, young at heart to join John Alou up front for the story of all ages.
Have you ever dreamed of finding buried treasure? Where would you find it?
In the ground.
Good answer. Well, I have a story this morning about buried treasure. This is a story that comes out of the Hasidic tradition. Anybody know what Hasidic means? Anybody out there know what Hasidic means? Oh, there are some people who know what it means. They're very observant Jews, very observant, very pious. They're studying the scriptures a lot. They're trying to be close to God. And this is about a particular Hasidic Jew who was known as Reb Isaac ben Yaakiel. Reb is it's kind of a title that to recognize what a pious man he is. And Isaac ben Yaakiel, that means Isaac, son of Yaakiel. So, Isaac ben Yaakiel. And he was so devoted and so devout that he spent all his time studying and trying to be close to God, and that didn't leave much time for making money, so he was also really, really poor. But one night, he had a dream. He had a dream that he found buried treasure. And he remembered from the dream exactly where it was. For one thing, it was in Prague. Now, he lived in Krakow. Do you know where Krakow is? Vaguely. Okay, you see, Ronan, of course, knows where Krakow is. It's in Poland. And do you know where Prague is? Czech Republic. And so they're kind of close together, but it's quite a journey from Krakow to Prague. But so he had this dream, and in the dream, this treasure was underneath this particular bridge that was in Prague, and he knew if he could get to Prague, he would find this bridge, and he would find this treasure. And so he spent the last of his money to get a train ticket to go to Prague, and he did. He rode long, long hours and hours and hours, and got to Prague, and then went in search of the bridge. And sure enough, he found it. It looked exactly like the bridge in his dream. The same walkway, the same posts. Everything was exactly the same except for one thing. There were guards. There were guards walking back and forth on this bridge because it was right next to where the king lived. Now, what was he going to do? How was he going to dig under this bridge when there's these guards? To what? Oh, well, maybe. But he didn't know what to do, so he just kind of stood there and watched and waited and tried to think of a plan, but he didn't think of a plan. So he came back the next day, and he stood and watched and waited and thought, well, maybe at some point the guards won't be paying attention and I can dig and find the treasure. But it didn't happen. So he came back the next day. And finally, one of the guards got a little tired of him just kind of hanging around and said, so, you've been here 3 days. What are you doing? Are you waiting for somebody? And he said, no. And he tried to think of a story that would work, and he couldn't think of anything. So he just told the truth. He said, I had this dream that there was a bridge in Prague, and there's a treasure buried underneath, and this is the exact bridge. And the guard just laughed at him. A dream, you silly, silly man. Dreams don't mean anything. Why, I had a dream. I had a dream that there was a treasure buried underneath a stove in Krakow that was in the house of Reb Isaac ben Yurik. And Reb Isaac ben Yurik said, "Oh, a treasure underneath the stove in Krakow." He said, "Well, I'm so sorry to have been any trouble." And he went back to the train station, went back on the train, moved his stove, dug under it, and indeed there was a treasure there. So that is a famous Hasidic story. And some people say that it means that your treasure is close to your heart, close to your home. And some people say that it means sometimes you have to travel a long way in order to come home and find what's of value there. And I say that sometimes to get your dream, your vision, to achieve that, you have to hear the dream and vision of someone else. And so you can go to your classes. Thank you.
All right, we're about to take the offering, and I'll pass these baskets. But I also want to note that on your seat beside you is a white piece of paper that John Lou is holding. And if you have any joy or concern you want to share for today, please write it down and put it in the basket.
No,
give it directly to the minister. Okay. Whatever she said is what it was supposed to be, yeah. Okay. And hear this reading. For the gifts we have received and the gifts which we ourselves are, may we be truly grateful.
Our joys and concerns bring us together and symbolize all the many links and bonds that exist among us. This morning, Sylvia, in an up-to-the-moment report, says that the flock of pelicans is swirling its way over our fellowship right now. Dick and Sylvia are also happy to be joined today by their old friend Paul Whitehouse, who's visiting Manhattan with his wife, Madonna Stallman. Glad to have you here today, Paul. And our friend Ann Martian, who used to live here and has gone off to the big city, shares both a joy and concern. Her son, George? Gio, I'm sorry. Gio will be moving from Lawrence, Kansas to Sunnyvale, California in November. He'll be leaving his job with Propylon, a Dublin-based company, to take a job with Google. They're going to own the earth soon. His mother, four sisters, and seven nieces and nephews in Kansas City are happy for him. This has been his dream, but we'll miss him tremendously. And Fred Reynolds is pleased that his 18-year-old cat is still eating and doing okay. And so we hold in our hearts all the joys and concerns that are shared and all that exist among us. I would mention that Sybil's father died, and so those of you who know her might want to reach out to her with condolences.
Okay. With our theme of vision, please ask you to take your hardbound hymnals, and we'll read a responsive reading. Number 610. And this was written by the Pakistani poet and scholar Muhammad Iqbal. The Journey of Love. 610. I will read the regular text to begin, and then you, the congregation, respond with the italicized text, and we'll go back and forth until we finish it. The Journey of Love. Where in our hearts is that burning of desire? It is true that we are made of dust, and the world is also made of dust, but the dust has motes rising. Whence comes that drive in us? Whence comes that storm? But sometimes, with a sigh, you can cross that vast desert. You may find sometime a treasure on your way. My heart and my eyes are devoted. Okay, get to sing one more time. Please join in hymn 190, Light of Ages and of Nations, in the hardbound hymn.
Controversial about that hymn we just sang? Deutschland über alles. So some of you may recognize, clearly someone has, that that's the tune of the German national anthem. Different words, but, you know, still recognizable. And the controversy around the German national anthem comes with its first and second verses, where you find that Deutschland über alles. And those aren't recognized as the anthem. It's only the only national anthem I know that only uses its third verse. The third verse is still recognized as the national anthem. Now, almost a century ago, when the Weimar Republic selected it as the national anthem in 1922, the verses did include that Deutschland über alles, Germany overall, along with outlining some of the boundaries of that nation. And those are the words, of course, that the German government now rejects. And German philosopher Nietzsche actually grumbled that the words marked the end of German philosophy. But where did the original intent come from? What was that original intent in those words? They were written in 1844 by August Heinrich Hoffmann von Falsenleben. And at the time, there was no unified Germany. There were broken little states. And it was actually liberals who hoped to unite under a single banner of Germany over all, Germany over all those separate states, not over all humanity or over all the world or any such thing, simply all of Germany united in a democratic spirit. So the vision of a united Germany morphed under the Nazis into a glorification of Germany as superior to other nations. All this to say, visions are tricky, aren't they? What looks and sounds good in this time and environment may be very different in another context. And if you look at the words we just sang with the song, Light of Ages and a Nation, every race and every time, they're a direct repudiation of the words of a superiority of one nation, a direct repudiation of Uber Alles. Every nation, every race, every time has received some vision of truth and goodness. Yet I still know people who refuse to sing these words to this tune. They refuse to sing this tune at all. And it's a strong enough feeling that if you turn back a page, there's actually an alternate tune with these words. And that's why. That's why there's an alternate tune, because there are some people who won't sing that tune. Context matters in vision. Sometimes even tragically so. Now, 3 weeks ago, I talked about how we can become locked into a particular lens that keeps us from seeing the whole of a situation. I know several of you were at Trevor Noah's performance Friday night, and he reminded me of that perspective as he spoke about how shocking it can be for men to encounter the world of gender violence and harassment that women and transgender people experience, how they simply cannot imagine that the world could be that way. He asked a female friend, "Do you know this?" "Of course," she said. And he also spoke about the world of racial discrimination that whites may be unable to see. We're learning as we listen to one another, and particularly to people whose experience has been marginalized, to the Me Too movement and to the Black Lives Matter movement, that it really is that bad. That our cultural expectations have been out of whack. Our culture has hurt people, often unintentionally, because good people have been unable to see an experience different from their own. They've been too locked into their own lenses. But this morning, my focus is a little different. What's outside of us that obscures our vision? Or as Langston Hughes famously puts it in his poem, Harlem, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust over and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? This is the stuff of which tragedy is built, denial or blocking of visions. In the tragedy, West Side Story, whose songs we heard earlier in the service, Tony and Maria sing beautifully of a place for us, a new way of living, a way of forgiving, something that they cannot quite describe specifically. It's somewhere, someday, vague. You might criticize such a gauzy, non-specific vision, but I rewatched that portion of the movie, and the words that heard the words that lead into the song. Maria says, "It's not us, it's everything around us." And Tony responds, "There's a place for us, a place of quiet and open air." They know they only get there together, but they can't fully describe it or say where it is. They don't say in the song, but we know that it is a place where hatred on account of ethnic origin does not exist, a place where rivalries are put to rest, and where love conquers all. The musical is a tragedy because though Tony and Maria have that vision, they don't find that place. Instead, Tony is shot by Chino, and there is, though, some edging toward the place for us at the end. Maria stops the gang warfare and does not commit suicide as Juliet, Shakespeare's model for Maria, does. Maria leaves us with some hope that maybe a vision can be accomplished. It raises questions for me, though, those differences between Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story. And you know, this is, I am a musical aficionado, so I love this stuff. But anyway, Tony is killed by someone else. Maria takes action and confronts the gangs. And in contrast, both Romeo and Juliet commit suicide when they believe that the other one is dead. And I wonder which is the more realistic ending. The utter despair that leads directly to death, or the rash action that may lead to something. And maybe neither is really the way to accomplish a vision. What do we do, though, when it's not us, it's everything around us? How do we hold on to a vision when the world keeps obscuring our sight, robbing us of what felt promised and maybe even came close? What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? I'm going to name a difference among us here today. Some of us are used to setting visions, dreaming dreams, building out the goals, and getting her done. We may have obstacles to overcome, challenges to conquer, or failures to learn from. Mostly, though, we have found imagining a better world, setting goals, and making things happen works for us. We have been Maria, shutting down the gang warfare. Anyone else kind of doubt that Maria really managed to shut down the gang war in the long term? Is that new ending too naive, perhaps? Shakespeare's original, well, not entirely original. He followed Arthur Brooke's 1562 poem. Anyway, his work leaves both protagonists dead, and their families reconcile as they grieve. And that might be what it takes for true repentance. Grievous loss, unimaginable sacrifice. It's not us. It's everything around us. And so I also name others among us, those who are not as used to setting visions and goals and mastering them. There are those who fear now to dream dreams because their visions have been so often short-circuited, cut off from coming true. When dreams have felt idle, mere imaginings that could not ever be real. Why identify a vision if you cannot see it accomplished, if the world keeps blocking and denying success, when the setbacks and denials come one after another, a lost job, a sick parent, a car accident? Life interferes with the goals we set and the dreams we dream. It's not us. It's everything around us. What happens to a dream deferred? Deferred is a gentle way to put it. Sometimes dreams are broken, pushed down by systems of oppression, by lack of resources, by the grit of living. I cannot honestly say that no matter your dream, you can achieve it. Nor can I say that every dream ought to be achieved. White nationalists have a clearly articulated vision that looks like a nightmare to me, not a vision that should be attained. And sometimes achieving a vision is about the work, the commitment, and determination we put into it, and sometimes failure doesn't have anything to do with us. So discernment. Discernment about what we are inspired to pursue, and discernment about what is possible, what is reality, and what next step might be promising. So I return to Maria. Did she force the vision too much, unrealistically? Did the warfare end for good? How many times have you seen something that looked like it was accomplished for a moment, but in the long run, nothing really changed? Recurrent wars, cycles of domestic violence, crises that ebb and return. There can be a mismatch between vision and reality. We haven't adequately discerned what's going on, and so our answers are short-sighted and ultimately fail. The reality in front of us matters, and we can't deny or wish away the here and now. You may have read Jeanette Wall's memoir, The Glass Castle. Has anybody read it or seen the movie? Yeah. Wall's father, her father's dream in the book is to build a glass castle. And that dream might be hard enough for someone with resources and engineering experience, but for a poor, nomadic, alcoholic father of four, ridiculous. Now, is it impossible because of the circumstances of his life or because of his personal failings? That may be too hard for anyone to sort out. One of the errors in casting a vision is casting too big a vision, something that is unachievable. It can sound naive. Remember Thoreau and the castles in the air? If you've built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them. Now, those foundations may be possible to build if your castle is 5 feet off the ground. They may be more challenging if your castle is 10 feet off the ground. And they may be impossible if your castle is a mile off the ground. Another error may be a failure of sight or a failure of imagination, assuming that we can actually see everything or being unable to imagine what we cannot see. UU minister Karen Herring writes of a summer day while fishing on a small lake. A bald eagle circles overhead as we cast our lines and waited. We watched the eagle rise, becoming smaller and smaller against the summer's wide blue sky. And finally, as we sat in the canoe, our faces turned up like baby birds in a nest, the tiny speck of an eagle circled one last time and then simply vanished, leaving us with the giddy sense that we'd been drawn right to the limits of our awareness and even a step beyond. The blue dome stretches seamlessly over our heads, and though we knew somewhere up there, the eagle was still circling, likely looking down on us with its sharp, focused vision. We saw only a cerulean expanse of sky garnished by a few wispy clouds along the horizon. I remember this, she writes, sometimes when looking at what appears to be an empty sky, or when whatever I can see is not enough to reveal all I know to be true. So how do we know these things invisible to us? How do we discern reality? We check it out with one another. Remember the story I told earlier. Reb Isaac ben Yaqiel had a piece of information he had seen in a dream. He believed there was a treasure under the bridge far from where he lived. Indeed, that treasure may have been there, but he did not have the information he needed until he heard someone else's dream, the guard at the bridge. Then he knew where to look for the treasure in his home. And, you know, though we might scoff at the specifics of the story, I think the underlying reality of that need to share our information, that need to share our dreams, that need to share our visions is real. If we count only on ourselves for our interpretation of reality and the feasibility of our visions, then we will fail, because we are not isolated beings, but part of something bigger. Poet and management consultant Margaret Wheatley points out that change does not always come incrementally in easily segmented linear steps. It's not always possible to lay out all those specific small goals and objectives. She describes the challenge of what she calls emergent systems and speaks of culture as an emergent system. Systems like this may have been created by component parts, but once they exist, the system rules the part. Complex interactions may produce unexpected results, which is not to say they don't have identifiable causes. But we may not be able to figure out the causes in advance, only in retrospect. So how to respond then? With living and learning, continual observation of the reality, and adjusting our visions and goals. And that means listening to others and reflecting on what's going on. The Dalai Lama has said that one cause of suffering, suffering, of course, is a central feature of Buddhist thought, that one cause of suffering is when good people begin their work together and then fail to notice what is arising between them. Part of the environment we need to discern is what is arising, what is happening in our relationships, whether work, family, or friendships, and just in our world, in our context, what is arising. Here's advice from Margaret Wheatley on turning to one another. There is no power greater than a community discovering what it cares about. Ask what's possible, not what's wrong. Keep asking. Notice what you care about. Assume that many others share your dreams. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Talk to people you know. Talk to people you don't know. Talk to people you never talked to. Be intrigued by the differences you hear. expect to be surprised. Treasure curiosity more than certainty. Invite in everybody who cares to work on what's possible. Acknowledge that everyone is an expert about something. Know that creative solutions come from new connections. Remember, you don't fear people whose story you know. Real listening always brings people closer together. Trust that meaningful conversations can change your world. Rely on human goodness and stay together. We live in a world right now that feels pretty unpredictable. Change is rapid. We learn new modes of communication almost weekly. We're bombarded by information without a solid grounding in what is trustworthy and true. We can't even rely on the earth that nourishes us because it too is in the midst of change. We know so much and understand so little. Our relational systems are complex and shifting. We have to keep our eyes open and our feet on the ground to cope. And sometimes our goals may have to be limited. If the world is utterly overwhelming, we may be able to do little more than survive it, creating pockets, corners of sanity and hope. Toni Morrison wrote in her novel Beloved about slaves, people who one might expect to have no hope, no vision. But she wrote of a way for them to find a circumscribed vision. Her unchurched preacher, Baby Suggs, gathered the people together outdoors in a woodland clearing. She told them, writes Toni Morrison, that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine. That if they could not see it, they would not have it. Here, she said, in this here place, we flesh, flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in grass, love it hard. Yonder they do not love your flesh. They despise it. They don't love your eyes. They'd just as soon pick them out. No more do they love the skin on your back. Yonder they flay it. And, oh, my people, they do not love your hands. Those they only use, tie, bind, chop off, and leave empty. Love your hands. Love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch others with them. Pat them together. Stroke them on your face, because they don't love that either. You got to love it. You. And no, they ain't in love with your mouth. Yonder out there, they will see it broken and break it again. What you say out of it, they will not heed. What you scream from it, they do not hear. What you put into it to nourish your body, they will snatch away and give you leavings instead. No, they do not love your mouth. You got to love it. This is flesh. This is flesh I'm talking about here. Flesh that needs to be loved. Feet that need to rest and to dance. Backs that need support, shoulders that need arms, strong arms, I'm telling you. And oh, my people out yonder, hear me, they do not love your neck, unnoosed and straight. So love your neck. Put a hand on it, grace it, stroke it, and hold it up. And all your inside parts that they'd just as soon slop for hogs, you gotta love them. The dark, dark liver, love it, and the beating heart, love that too. More than eyes or feet, more than lungs that have to draw free air, more than your life-holding womb and your life-giving private parts, hear me now, love your heart, for this is the prize. Saying no more, she stood up then and danced with her twisted hip, the rest of what her heart had to say, while the others opened their mouths and gave her the music. If they could not see it, they could not have it. They created community. They created love, love for themselves, love for one another. They created a vision together, a vision of loving themselves and one another, no matter what the rest of the world over yonder said. And sometimes that's the task before us. Sometimes we can create a larger vision, and sometimes we can only create a circumscribed one, but we have to discern together what are the circumstances. And so I invite you now into contemplation, breathing, being relaxed, being aware of your body in this space. What do you need to envision now, today? If you have succeeded well with your visions and dreams, what's next? And what would happen if you let the awareness of other people's visions and dreams shape yours? What might you discover? If your visions and dreams have been thwarted by circumstances and broken by the vagaries of life, who do you need to help you rebuild a vision you can hold on to and perhaps accomplish? If your visions and dreams have worn out and you find yourself caught up in day-to-day activity without a vision, without a direction, what keeps you from finding a new one? How might you discover the treasure in your own house? Today, what obscures your vision? What defeats your vision? What is next for you? Before I open up to some general discussion, I'd like you to find one or two other people and just do a little sharing around your vision in your life now. Find somebody you know, find someone you don't know. What did Margaret Wheatley say? Talk to people you know, talk to people you don't know, talk to people you never talk to. So, do we have people who want to share? Raise your hand, and Gene has the microphone. He'll bring it to you. You can tell us who you are and whatever it is you want to say.
Sabrina Booker, I've always had a lot of dreams and different aspirations, but the problem is picking one. And the thing is, I have to find out what I really want to do and what I'm really capable of doing. But you talk about awareness. I'm very aware of one thing. We have crickets in here.
Yeah, the crickets have been serenading us. a great deal. Now, I know people have things to say, because when I told you to talk to each other, you talked.
Okay. So I'll summarize Mickey's vision, which Jimmy and I very much agreed with, and that is a world in which our environment allows us to continue to live.
Yeah, it sounds modest, but that's huge.
Jim Chanteau. I was trying to think how many years I was a member here. I joined in 1971, I think, and then left last December to join the Columbia, Missouri Unitarian Universalist Church. They were formed roughly the same time as Manhattan Unitarians were, that is, the middle 1950s. But they, as part of joining their church, you have to learn a little about their history. And so I heard about how they got formed. They didn't come to an already existing building like this one was. I mean, we expanded it, but this was Oak Grove School back in the day. What the Columbia Unitarians did is they had a plot of land that was contributed to them by one of the members on the outskirts of town. It's now in the middle of town, but in those days it was way out on the edge of town. They met every Sunday on the university campus as a small group, and then they would, in mass, bring buckets to a faucet, fill up water, drive out to their unbuilt church, and water trees, which they had planted in the springtime. And they did that for many years. And those trees today are 50, 100 feet tall, surround the church. Now, that is a vision. And you have to admire. The thing is, none of those people are around anymore. It's the people there now, like me, who can enjoy their vision. And that's the thing about visions, is they often carry long beyond the here and now into people that you don't know and will never meet.
I hate to be negative about this, but I find it very difficult to have a vision if you see no path to that vision. Mm-hmm. So right now, mm-hmm. when you're talking about environment or maybe mm-hmm. peace or maybe feeding people or maybe healthcare or something, it's hard for me to have a vision that is not just some unimaginable thing, because I don't see a path to those the way things are going right now. So I find it very difficult on those things to have a vision. And some of the rest of you and I have been working with the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice for many years. And the board has talked a lot about vision this last year and decided to change the direction of the vision to more doable, small, local issues. And that's sort of the way they're going now. And so that was a change in vision, because these big visions of us changing U.S. foreign policy wasn't quite working out.
It felt like that castle a mile high in the sky. Yeah.
To plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow.
The small steps matter.
A brand new member dares to speak.
Hi, everyone.
I'm Maya. I'm new here. My vision is just for people to be nicer to each other. I think we tend to lose our empathy when we meet somebody who has a different vision or believes something different than us, and then we don't see them as a human. We don't see them as having, you know, more than just their political belief or more than just their religion. So I think empathy is really important, especially now.
And Harriet Yonke, and she spoke to exactly what my quilt's about that's out here, that we're all in this world together. We've got to be kind to each other.
Linda Johnson. We all have lots of goals like saving the environment and bringing about peace and justice and so forth. There's not a lot that I can do to bring about all those goals, but I'm doing the best I can right now to take small steps, to work with other people, and to get out the vote.
Mm-hmm. Knowing that the small steps matter.
Gosh, when you told us to do this, I just told Alex and Link, who I just met, that I just live 10 minutes at a time. But I just realized that what's happening with me is what all of you have said, that I'm now focusing on what's right under my nose, and I'm just trying to do the most ethical and trying to be kind and trying to be a better person just like minute by minute. And then even like I've been in charge of grounds for just forever, and so many people have contributed to grounds, but so I've had this vision of making it kind of productive for life, wildlife and even people. And somebody died and their children left us money for a tree, so we planted a peach tree at the suggestion of the RE people, and it had two peaches this year. That's a start. And this year I planted a persimmon tree, and it's still alive because I carried buckets of water all summer. And oh well, little things matter, and I have to feel all the pieces matter and come together, and we do touch each other in little ways and affect bigger things together.
I was just reminded, as I've hearing everybody this last week at K-State, there was the second event, Wildcat Dialogues, second year in a row. I was a facilitator there, and I think I'm beginning to realize this more and more, that I think a big or a small-scale vision that may have big consequences for me is figuring out how to dialogue with differences, different people. This has been a struggle of mine because of, maybe it's my age, but I latch on to a new idea and I swing over to the other side of the pendulum, and that gets in the way of visions, that gets in the way of this vision to be able to connect with people who are different. But I think maybe this is just going to be an ongoing struggle for me, and a vision that never really realizes itself completely, because I struggle with truly believing that certain people, certain visions that seem to do harm, how do I dialogue with people with visions that do harm? And you touched on this earlier. But something in me still says, try, you know, but easier said than done.
The people remain worthwhile and have dignity and worth, even if their ideas are antithetical to everything you believe.
Hi, excuse me, Roger Johnson. Excuse me. My wife Linda a few minutes ago said something that just triggered a memory from my distant past. She said that we're all in favor of world peace and, you know, and improving the environment, but what can we do about it? And that reminded me of an incident in the 1960s when I was at the Johns Hopkins University, And I had a student who had gone on to New York City to work, and he came back to see me. And while he was in New York, he met a policeman named David Dirks. And that policeman, by the way, had an even more famous partner, Frank Serpico. But David Dirks loved to go to college campuses to try to persuade young people to become a cop. And he made the point, he said, look, what can you do about ending the war in Vietnam? What can you do? Virtually nothing. But if you're a cop, you've got a lot of the law at your fingertips because you're dealing with individuals. And he said, in the years I've been a cop, I've never written anybody up for smoking marijuana, but I have written up industrial places that are polluting the air. When you're a cop, you have a lot of things at your control where you're dealing with individuals on a one-to-one basis.
So all of our interactions matter. We'll let that be the last comment. And our hymn is number 324, Where My Free Spirit Onward Leads. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Closing words I offer have long been attributed to Universalist pioneer John Murray. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of all people. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God.